have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover, starting with a new initiative. Is that in time for Tuesday?
Well, actually, the initiative hasn't been officially launched yet. It's just an intention to launch this initiative. The coalition of social justice groups, including the Sierra Club, Real Change Newspaper, and United African Public Affairs Committee, announced this week that they were going to launch an initiative that they want to make the ballot next August. It's to limit the city of Seattle's liability for cost overruns in construction of the tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct. What I find kind of interesting is that in reporting on this, the local media always refers to the Alaskan Way Viaduct replacement tunnel as a $1.96 billion project. However, when you read the details, of course, the state says, well, the project, the total budget is $4.2 billion, but then the state's portion of the project is capped at $2.8 billion. Well, if you add $2.8 billion to the $1.96 billion that the local media describes the project as being, you come up with what, Job? About $5
billion? $4.8 billion, yeah.
Yeah, about close to $5 billion. So you have to start asking yourself, okay, how much is this project gonna, you know, be? Is it $4 billion? Is it $1.96 billion? Is it $2.8 billion?
It's a couple $100,000. That's all. It's really cheap.
You have to remember that back when this project was first proposed in the original design process, they estimated that the State Department of Transportation estimated that it would cost between $7 and $11 billion.
Yeah.
And then they started fudging with the details, and now it's down to like 4.2 and
yeah,
1.2.
They started dropping the cost for the same project at the same time that they started hiking the cost for the competing, much less expensive projects.
Yes, yes.
As to make it politically more sellable.
Yes. And so we need to remember this, that the state portion of the project is capped at $2.8 billion. The city's portion of the project has no cap, and that's what this initiative would do. So I find this to be really good news, and I hope that they get the language finalized and get the initiative filed and out for people to sign as soon as possible.
Yeah, meanwhile, Mayor McGinn and Governor Gregoire were going back and forth this weekend over this same issue, the idea of whether the legislature should cap the cost or not. And McGinn has been insisting all along, of course, that the city is on the hook for cost overruns under the original enabling legislation from the state legislature. Well, Gregoire attempted to head this off at the pass this week. She turned down McGinn's request that she put a bill before the legislature, clarifying the intent of the legislature. McGinn is saying, well, if that's the intent of the legislature, that the state pick up the cost, well, then why not just have them codify that? And Gregoire is saying, no, I can't do that. But what I will do is I think that the state legislature would need to pass additional legislation in order to collect on this, so I will veto any such legislation. Now, very quickly, what's wrong with that particular pledge?
I don't know,
tick,
Jav.
Tick, 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 tick. The problem with it is that, of course, cost overruns would probably come toward the end of the project.
Exactly.
The project, of course, is supposed to be completed in 2015 or 2016, and if it runs on time. Well, of course, Governor Gregoire almost certainly will not be in office at that time. So it is a completely meaningless pledge.
Yeah, exactly. Even if it comes in the middle of the project, she may not be in office.
Yeah, she's widely expected not to run for re-election in 2012, and, you know, Rob McKenna is expected to run for election in 2012 against Jay Inslee, and nobody knows really where either of those people stand on the project, but neither of them are from Seattle and don't have a political base in Seattle.
Yeah, and meanwhile, this is the week that the two companies who were bidding on the project, the two tunnel construction companies bidding on the project, put in their bids with the state, and of course, Gregoire accepted the bids, and she said, well, all I can tell you about them is that they came in on budget, and I'm still asking, what's the budget? You know, I'm not exactly clear on that part of it.
And what are the details of the bids? Because we haven't seen
anything. It's like they're a state secret. Of course, they just came in on Friday, but still, it'd be nice to have some details.
I thought I read something that said that, and the details will be revealed in December.
Yes. Why
of
wait?
Of 2026.
Why wait 2 months. I don't get it. Anyway.
All right. Well, speaking of in office, we got an election coming up just a couple days from now.
Yeah, the deadline for mailing back the mail-in ballots is November 2nd. And, of course, nationally, a lot of the polls are showing that a lot of truly disturbed people are going to be in the House and Senate come January.
I'm actually tired of seeing all those polls myself.
Well, I think a lot of people are. but at the same time, there's really not a lot anybody here can do about any of that. But the one poll that does affect us locally is that it looks like, according to public opinion surveys, and it's a question of how much stock you put in those, Dino Rossi has pulled even with Senator Patty Murray in terms of the Senate race. Susan DelBene, the Democratic challenger to Dave Reichert on the east side in the 8th Congressional District, has also been closing the margin in that race. So those two look like they're going to be very tight races. And so if you have a particular stake in one of those other races, such as, I don't know, keeping somebody who's denying the existence of climate change out of office for the next 6 years, just to pick a random example, you might want to make sure that you get that ballot in the mail and get your friends to do the same.
Some of the initiatives are very close, too, like the liquor privatization initiatives appears to be really close.
Yeah, and some of the advertising on that is just dreadfully missed. I actually heard I forget whether it was 1100 or 1105 making the claim in one of their ads that it's going to save the state money.
Yeah.
By, you know, that would be in the presuming that the state
is. Probably it was 1105.
Yeah, probably.
That's been their argument all along.
Yeah, because that would mean that the state is actually losing money selling hard liquor, and somehow I just really doubt that's the case.
Yeah.
Because frankly, if it's a money losing proposition, why are these big companies so anxious to get out on the act?
Yeah.
All right, so a quick poll. Are you more tired of hearing about polls or receiving robocalls?
Robocall. Well, I don't. I have a very easy and very simple robocall blocker. It's called an answering machine, but that means, of course, I can't pick up any calls while I'm at home, which is very annoying. But what I find
caller ID.
What I find most annoying are the continuous ads on TV and radio and the internet for the election, and the continuous media coverage too. And you have to remember too that the local media makes a lot of its money during campaign season by selling
these
ads.
This is their Christmas.
They jack up the rates and everything to collect as much as they possibly can. It's just another way in which money is I feel extremely wasted on this kind of advertising and this kind of campaigning.
And one of the sad truths behind this whole, you know, supposed Tea Party resurgence is that a lot of it is being funded by big business. The Citizens United decision has resulted. I mean, we've seen more of these ads now than in past elections by a staggering amount. A lot of that's going to the Republicans. A lot of it's coming from big business and these sort of shadowy, you know, front groups that don't have to reveal where their money is coming from. You know, that rather than any kind of genuine grassroots populism is what's driving a lot of this narrative.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Moving on to national and new fuel economy standards.
Yeah, this week the Obama administration announced new fuel economy standards for heavy vehicles, including tractor trailers, buses, delivery vans, heavy pickups, etc. Of course, the fuel economy standards won't go into effect until 2014. But what they are made up of are basically fuel consumption reductions of about 10 to 20%. That will be required for these vehicles by the year 2018. Now, the study that these standards are based upon that was done by the National Academy of Sciences found that with existing technology, fuel economy technology, these heavy vehicles could save fuel use by about one third to one half. So setting the standard at 10 to 20% is particularly anemic, given that with current technology, you could save fuel consumption. You could cut fuel consumption by one third to one half.
And it would take very little time to implement that technology.
Yeah,
it's not going to take 8 years.
Yeah, it would not take 8 years.
Bearing in mind that, you know, the average fuel consumption of the fleet of cars that's on the road right now is actually lower than it was during the Arab oil embargo in 1973. So that tells you a lot. And, you know, there weren't computers in cars in 1973. So that tells you an awful lot about where the status of the cutting edge technology is versus what's actually being made available in the marketplace.
Yeah. And, you know, fuel use by heavy vehicles that are covered by this, by these new standards, that's one of the fastest growing sectors of global warming emissions in the world. If you look at everything and you kind of separate it out, it's the fastest growing sector of the transport emissions, but certainly of all global warming emissions. So really, it's the place where dramatic cuts should have come, and they didn't. And of course, the Obama administration came up with these new emission standards after consulting with guess who? Vehicle manufacturers and trucking companies.
Are they in Michigan by any chance?
Yeah.
All right. Well, sticking with the concept of oil, the Gulf oil spill developments there.
Yeah, the first report this week came out from the commission investigating who and what was to blame for the massive Gulf oil spill, the largest oil spill accident in U.S. history. And they determined that the cement used by Halliburton to plug the well was at fault. Halliburton did three tests on the cement leading up to the time that the cement was poured into the well, and all three tests showed that it didn't meet industry standards. On March 8th, Halliburton, before the oil spill occurred in April, gave BP the results of one of those tests, and BP chose not to do anything about it. So both companies knew that the cement was not up to snuff, but they went ahead and used that cement in the well anyway. As Halliburton spokesman Thomas Roth said, that cement mixture has been used on more than 1,000 other wells successfully. So that
raises an interesting question.
Are there other wells out there that are plugged with faulty cement, and what does that mean for the safety of the environment?
Bear in mind that their test results came back, and this is a direct quote, that they were incapable of holding back oil and gas.
Yeah, completely incapable. And the commission that's been investigating who's to blame for the spill, they had obtained samples from Halliburton of the cement, gave it to a lab managed by Chevron, and that lab tested it 9 times, and the cement failed all 9 tests. Of course, Halliburton is now saying, well, you didn't do tests on the correct cement mixture. And I have to just say, excuse me, that's the mixture you gave to the commission to do the tests on. If that's not the correct mixture, then your company is not only negligent when it comes to the oil spill, it's also incompetent.
Well, or if it's not the correct mixture, did you give them a different mixture because you thought this mixture would work better?
Yes. So apparently the cement's only passed 1 test in its entire life, and that's the quick profits test.
All right. Moving on to developments relating to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, we talked about this when it just came, had just come out last week, the massive WikiLeaks document dump of classified documents relating to the Afghan war over the past several years. And we had just made the notice that, you know, the coverage this morning in places like the New York Times and Washington Post is a very different emphasis from the coverage in The Guardian and other English periodicals in Europe that are coming out with information on this. And we had a chance to see how that played out over a period of a couple of days during the news cycle, and it really was kind of staggering. Counterspin talked about this a little bit, but the extent to which the WikiLeaks revelations were literally buried by U.S. media, Washington Post editorial, for example, said basically, and this is a very common sentiment in U.S. media, there's nothing new here. It's all old news. Well, that's not exactly true. Not only is information from the Bush administration not old news, because we had a number of documents relating to U.S. policy from those years that had not been made public before, but some of those policies, particularly the U.S. policy of military policy of looking the other way when Afghan and Iraqi soldiers are, Iraq in this case, I think I said Afghanistan earlier, when Iraqi soldiers were known to abuse detainees and prisoners, and the U.S. literally would give them those prisoners, and certainly the U.S. was funding and training the regimens that were and the squads that were torturing and sometimes executing these people. When the U.S. knew this was going on, there was a state and or got a complaint and was asked to investigate that something had happened. There was a stated U.S. military policy of looking the other way and ignoring the allegations that is still going on today. Some of the documents from the WikiLeaks scandal were as recent as last December. That's during the Obama administration. That's current policy. And, you know, that is not safely buried in the past. That is not something we knew before. But, and all of this was very clearly spelled out if you read the British press, if you read the European press, but it was nowhere to be found in the U.S. press.
Yeah, and the European press really pointed out these people are being treated the same way. These detainees are being treated the same way prisoners were treated under Saddam Hussein, and that's a scandal. And of course, it did not make the news for very long here, if at all. So find that a media scandal.
Yeah, we're much more concerned about, you know, Christine O'Donnell or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, in the economic news this week, the Special Inspector for the Troubled Assets Relief Program said this week that the U.S. Treasury is hiding the full extent of the potential taxpayer losses on AIG. In early October, the U.S. Treasury issued a report, and you may remember this a couple weeks ago, that a report about what potential taxpayer losses would be from the bailout. And they said that about $5 billion were the expected losses on the U.S. Treasury's investment in AIG. That is the rescue of AIG. But the Inspector General cited an earlier estimate of $45 billion in losses. And he said, what's the difference? Well, the difference comes from the fact that the U.S. Treasury's recent report in October looked at a projection of future profits when stock is eventually sold to the general public. That's if the stock price remains what it is today. In other words, they were looking at an unrealized gain or loss from the sale of the U.S. Treasury's stock that it currently owns in AIG. But the $45 billion loss is an estimate from an actual audit of current realized gains and losses. In other words, it reflects current reality rather than some future expectation of what you might get if you sell stock, when, you know, et cetera. Furthermore, if you look at the details, only about 21% of all of AIG's company stock is publicly traded right now. The government owns about 79% of the company in the form of preferred stock. The government would have to exchange that preferred stock for common stock, in which case it will then own about 92% of the company's outstanding common stock, and then it would have to sell that to the public at a price that the stock trades at today. Now, if a single entity like the U.S. government owns 92% of the stock in a company, and you try to sell all that at once, you are not going to get the current going right. The price is going to drop, and it's going to drop precipitously. So trying to base your potential gain or loss on the sale of 92% of the stock at some point in the future and hoping that the price will stay the same as it is now, that's wishful thinking. That's a fairy tale. And that's essentially what the U.S. Treasury is telling the U.S. public in terms of what their potential loss will be on AIG.
By the way, isn't AIG the folks that along with BIAW have put a lot of money into 1082 to try and privatize our state L&I system?
I don't know.
Just curious about that.
But insurance companies, yeah, they are big donors behind that initiative. And then also in the economic news this week, the U.S. government had its first bond issue where investors paid more for the bonds than the par value of the bond. So take, for example, a bond that whose par value is $1,000, meaning that when you get the principal back, you're going to get a $1,000 check for that bond. Most of the time, investors buy those bonds at less than $1,000, and that the difference between what they pay for the bond when they buy it and what they get when they receive the bond at the end of its life is part of their return on the bond. But when you have a bond whose face value is $1,000, when it matures, you're going to get $1,000 back, and you buy it for more than $1,000, that means the government is essentially borrowing money from you at a negative interest rate. And that means that investors are initially taking a loss on that investment. Why are they doing this? Why are investors doing this? Well, it's because they're gambling that the rate of inflation is going to go up. The bonds that they bought for more than par value, those bonds are inflation protected, meaning that as inflation goes up, those investors are going to get more money back on the bond than its par value. So they're basically saying, investors are basically saying, well, because of current government policy, we expect inflation to skyrocket. And they're saying that because, as I've talked about in the last couple of weeks of the show, the U.S. government's policy is currently to deal with the economic downturn by using monetary policy instead of fiscal policy. That means monetary policy means that the U.S. Treasury and the Fed are going to be buying up long-term debt to try to control interest rates, to keep the interest rates down. In other words, they're printing money and pouring it into the economy. However, when you print more money and pour it into the economy, that's risking inflation. The value of the dollar goes down. People have to pay more for goods to buy the same goods, particularly imported goods. They have to pay a lot more, and that's when you have inflation. So investors are basically gambling that, yep, that's what's going to happen, massive inflation. Well, inflation is one of those things, if you want a double dip recession, sure, let's jack up the rate of inflation. That's going to do it quicker than just about anything else you can think of. But if you think about it politically, the government could avoid that if they change from monetary policy to a fiscal policy. That is, government spending on economic stimulus projects to create jobs and to get the economy going. Of course, the political environment right now is such that the Republicans are screaming about the deficit. Therefore, Americans believe that the deficit really is a problem, and hence that forces the government's hand. They have to concentrate on a monetary policy. They simply can't pursue Congress and the president simply can't pursue a fiscal policy at a time when that's exactly what they need to do.
All right. Let's move on to international, starting with Iraq.
Yeah, in Iraq, the Supreme Court ordered parliament back into session. The Iraqi parliament, after the elections in early March, met approximately once in June for about 18 minutes, and then the Speaker of the parliament sent everyone home but kept the session open indefinitely. He did not adjourn the session. That did two things. It gave time to the parties to try to form a government, but it also allowed every member of parliament to continue to collect their paychecks, which average about $11,000 per month.
That's nice work if you can get it.
Oh, it certainly is. And in the meantime, the political stalemate in Iraq has continued. Two Shiite parties have united, but they still don't have enough seats to form a majority, to form a government. They're still courting the Kurds, and the Kurds will only join a government if the winner of the elections, the party that's led by Ayad Alawi, which is primarily a Sunni and secular party, can also join that coalition, and the Shiites don't want to unite with them. So the stalemate continues.
All right. And Afghanistan.
Yeah, in Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, this has been in the news for the last couple of weeks. First accusations came out by a whistleblower that the government of Hamid Karzai was taking cash from Iran, big piles of cash, payments of between $1 million to $6 million in each box of cash that comes from Iran. And Hamid Karzai this week finally stood up and said, well, yes, I am taking cash from Iran, but I'm also taking cash from the U.S.
And that amount to billions of dollars.
Billions of dollars just that go into his private slush fund. So if you were wondering how it is that Hamid Karzai and his allies, the warlords of Iran of Afghanistan can pay voters to go to the polls and vote for him and not his opposition. and how they can rig the election, well, that's part of the reason that they can do that. If you're also wondering how all of the rulers, current rulers in Afghanistan, from Hamid Karzai on down, can afford to own luxurious villas in Dubai, that's also how they manage it.
And if you're wondering where the money might come from to, you know, fund health care or save Social Security or any of those big ticket items that we're not covering in the government in this country, well, that's where the money is going.
Yes, that's one potential place we could find cost savings in the U.S. budget. Also, you know, Jav, you were talking about all of the money that major U.S. corporations are pouring into the elections here to elect Republican candidates and to defeat initiatives like the initiative to tax rich people in the state of Washington. Well, you know, that's another place where we could look for money to plug the deficit hole.
Yeah, by the way, people keep referring to that as the income tax initiative and the initiative to tax rich people. But the really salient feature of it for most people is it will save a lot of people money on their tax dollars. That's actually a tax reduction initiative for most people.
It's a tax cut for most people. Yeah.
That reminds me of polling that's been out showing that most people were completely unaware that there was a tax cut under the Obama administration. They think that the Obama administration has actually raised their taxes, and they have not.
No, in fact, it has not. And the Obama administration's stated policy is not to raise taxes for most people, only for people who are, rich.
Yeah. It was interesting watching some of the press conferences at the White House that one can see on C-SPAN about the bags of cash incidents. None of the reporters there seem to remember the U.S. pallets of cash that went missing in Iraq.
Like $9 billion that went missing in Iraq that couldn't be accounted for.
Yeah. And that the inspector general afterwards said, hey, where did all this money go? Nobody kept track of it. It just disappeared.
And there's been reports of similar amounts of money being missing in Afghanistan as well.
Yeah. And what I want to know is why people don't stand up at these election forums and ask the candidates, you know, what happened when we invaded Iraq? You told us that the war would pay for itself. What happened? Here we are, you know, billions, if not trillions of dollars in the hole now on these two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's money down the toilet. You know, we're not getting any of that back.
Well, people can't remember 2 years ago, let alone 10.
Yeah, true.
All right, events.
Yeah, several events coming up. Of course, this morning, and in fact, it's going to start in a couple of minutes here, the Rally to Restore Sanity and the March Keep Fear Alive, the John Stewart and Stephen Colbert rallies. The Seattle offshoot of that will be happening down at Westlake Park. Sounds like it'll be a lot of fun, starting at 9 o'clock this morning and going through noon. Tuesday is Election Day, of course. That's the deadline to mail in ballots. Also, if you're concerned about schools, at 8:10 on Tuesday morning, that sounds a lot like a school time, doesn't it? And it is. Between 8:10 and 10 a.m., Dr. Maria Goodloe-Johnson, the superintendent of Seattle School, will be having a community chat at North Beach Elementary School. Naturally, that's in North Ballard because it's an elementary school that's still open. So that's at 9018 24th Avenue Northwest in Seattle if you want to go ask Dr. Goodloe-Johnson something about Seattle schools. Also in Ballard that evening, Colonel Ann Wright, the Iraq War dissenter, she's looking pretty good on that score at this point. And she was involved in she's done a lot of peace activism stuff since leaving the government. She was involved in the Gaza flotilla that was attacked by the Israeli military several months ago, and she will be in town raising money for a new Gaza flotilla. That's 7 o'clock Tuesday night at Trinity United Methodist Church, 6512 23rd Avenue Northwest in Ballard. So go and check that out.
And that's a sliding scale. It's to raise money, so it's dinner is $15 to $25 is what they're asking for.
Right,
people,
but you can certainly give more.
Yeah, certainly give more. And also, it's really key to let them know ahead of time if you plan to attend that, because they have to make the right number of dinners there, and you don't want them to make, you know, too much or too little.
Yeah, so for more information on that, you can email projectsafehaven@hotmail.com or call 206-499-1220.
All right. talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Well, as you may have gathered, there is an election coming up, and we covered this a couple of weeks ago on this show, but we have our handy-dandy Eat the State election endorsements and recommendations, and you can find that on the website at www.eatthestate.org. We go through all those annoying initiatives and all the small print ballot measures and all the candidates as well. www.eatthestate.org. You also find the print edition of our election issue at places where you find free publications around town, bookstores, periodic coffee houses, King County Library System, et cetera, et cetera. And we are looking for a couple of editors for Eat the State right now. We're looking for a new calendar editor, and we're also looking for a co-editor. There's more information on that on the Eat the State blog at eatthestate.org, or you can email us at editorial@eatthestate.org.